In the name of God. In the name of God, our companion on the journey, at our journey's end. Well, I certainly needed God as my companion last night and this morning. Something doesn't want me to preach this sermon to you. We had a keyboard meltdown when a smoothie got dumped on it. And this morning, the printer refused to work. So God needs to help me remember, because of course I left it till this morning to type out my points that I was going to make. So bear with me. You'll notice in your bulletin this morning, in your Ben Weekly this morning, it speaks of a new Hollister class beginning this Thursday. And we are going to consider process theology and our relationship with God. Well, I thought it might be interesting to look at Jesus' baptism with a process theology lens. But first I wanted to say a few words about process theology. Obviously, there are many layers, and like any theology, there are complexities. But what I want to sort of focus on this morning, for our purposes, is the relationship that God has with each individual. The God, I'm going to use the term God, but you could just say eternal being. And, you know, God, so bear with me again. Anyway, in process theology, God is affected by our choices. God is not the being that we heard about growing up, pulling puppet strings to get us to do what we want, issuing decrees, what we used to call in seminary the unmoved mover. He set things in motion and didn't intervene except sometimes in negative ways. This has been the traditional understanding of God with dogma. And I've been reading a book called Process Theology for the Perplexed. And John read it and said it's a reasonable book. I assume there are other books for the perplexed out there. But in it, the process theologian who wrote it contrasts process theology with the theology behind many churches' beliefs. And in particular, he mentions Rick Warren and leading the purposeful life. There's a quote in this book that says, that from Warren, says that God determines your fate. And that means everything negative, everything positive, God is involved. If it's a negative thing, God is sending it to correct you, to help you develop some characteristic. Well, that doesn't work for me. process theology really does, and I'll tell you why. One of the understandings of process theology is that God is constantly, continuously interacting with each of us in different ways, because we're unique, to offer us options that would help us fulfill our potential, would be life-giving, not just for ourselves or family, but for the world, for our communities, for all who are our brothers and sisters. But then the process goes that when God has offered you the options for your life, depending on what you decide, God then, you either expand those possibilities or you limit them further. And let me give you some examples. Because God doesn't go against our free will. God takes that into consideration, and God, which would be unheard of, lightning bolt in a traditional church, God is changed by us, by each of us and our decisions. So anyway, let me get back to the example. And we will get to Jesus' baptism, if you bear with me. God offers options. And depending if we take them, great, he can offer better options. I'm saying God can offer better options. But if we decide to ignore or go against God's options, well, God doesn't go off and sulk or judge us. God gives us new options within the limitations of our choices. For instance, a very general example would be, say, I am in a grocery store and I decide I am going to rob that grocery store because I want to buy something expensive for myself. Well, God doesn't intervene. You can do that. But then your options are more limited. If you do something that is bad enough and gets sent to jail or prison, well, God takes your circumstances, say, within the prison, and offers you the most life-giving choices for those new circumstances, such as perhaps education, rehabilitation. Again, you can refuse it. And then God continues to offer you constantly, and that's why it's called process, positive, life-giving options, not just for you, but maybe for the rest of the prison population. Anyway, a more everyday example. During the Depression years, and even now, maybe especially now, say someone who had a brilliant academic career was in college, but forced to drop out because of the circumstances, say, a health problem or family health problem or having to get a job because of poverty. Well, so God will offer each of us options that are will enable us to meet our potential as fully as possible within the new circumstances. And I imagine you can see why this would be appealing to me. For the past 30 years, 30 plus years, I have had lots of changes, so has John, due to health issues. And each time I've been able to maintain hope and move forward in the new circumstances because I can trust that whatever happens, whatever hole I fall into or stupid mistake I make or conscious decision I make, God will be there and will be offering me, if I'm only walking with my eyes open, will be offering me new life-giving, potential-filling options in the new limited circumstances. So you can see why I begin all my sermons, God, my companion on the journey, and my journey's end. Because without that constant one-on-one receiving of positive options from God, I wouldn't be able to make it. I find that to deal with whatever comes up, I need to be able to maintain hope each day. If I lose hope, forget it. It's a black pit. So anyway, that's the example. And I realize I'm getting a little lengthy here. And it shows about God something called panentheism. Not pantheism, where everything, God is in everything. Panentheism is everything, the whole creation, the planets, animals, humans, are in God. And I have a sort of image that came to me when I first heard about panentheism. And it's this. We are all in the womb of God. And there we experience, much like a baby would with a pregnant mother, the well-being and the desire for the best possible outcomes for all those residing in God's womb, and the knowledge that all God wishes for us, like a mother for the baby in her womb, is wholeness. So, where does this leave us with Jesus' baptism? You might ask. Jesus, why did Jesus need to be baptized? I'm not sure what's happening here, but hopefully it won't erase my quotes. When Jesus was baptized, he got the assurance that he was, in fact, loved and supported and in an extremely special relationship with the Creator. And in the chapter following his baptism, what happens? Jesus is sent into the wilderness and is tempted by, we'll call the devil, for what? Satan, I guess the Bible calls him. And for me, my understanding is that when he went into the desert, he was at the beginning of his ministry, and God wanted to show him that the strongest temptation, the worst possible scenario that he and the disciples might encounter, he now, through his baptism, had the ability to choose positive options. And I think that's one of the things that can be said about Jesus, is after his baptism, he, if you look at the Bible, he didn't always choose popular paths, but they were always life-giving, either for someone in the community or for the structural situation they were in under Roman occupation. And I don't think he would have been able without his baptism. And what were the temptations? They were the temptations, power, influence, material wealth. Hold on. I'm going to shut this off for a minute. Siri wants to butt in. The temptations that he experienced were temptations that were actually, well, they were actually factors of daily life in Israel at that time under Roman occupation. Power, influence, money, so forth, coercion, and he was able to resist. But what would it have looked like if he hadn't been able to resist? If when he came back from the desert, he had said yes and chosen poorly, obviously God would continue to offer him new options. But I tend to think God would have been sorely hurt because he was kind of engaged in the outcome. And what would it have looked like when he came back if he had given in? What would it have looked like in the community of his followers? Would he even be able to attract followers? After all, why would he be any different than the tyrants, the tyrant kings, the leaders of the Jewish community from the temple? All those who sought to imitate the Roman values, how would he be different? Who would he attract? What would their life together look like? I imagine it wouldn't be too life-giving. But nevertheless, we don't have to really go in depth that way, because obviously Jesus chose the most life-giving solution. Where does that leave us? Well, if I can get it back, I have a quote here. By none other than Albert Einstein. And he says, 100 times a day, I remind myself that my inner and outer life depend on the labors of other people, living and dead, and that I must exert myself in order to give in the full measure I have received and am still receiving. So, as we come to the inauguration of our president, I got to thinking about those first weeks following the election and those in my community of friends were despairing. What can we do? How can we bring hope and positive whatever and life in this situation? As we watched the president-elect day by day choose people to lead agencies that in fact would destroy the agency or totally change its mission. Well, several of my friends and I found myself doing the same thing. We couldn't, for the first couple of weeks, read the New York Times with breakfast. Because every single article was about the president-elect and what he was planning to do and not do. And to read left us in a place of no hope. But then I got to thinking about it, and I thought that we are called, as Donna said last week in her wonderful sermon, if I can bring up the, she said, talking about Mary pondering about Jesus' birth, she said, we might find, or we should find, the right song, the unique song for each of us to sing. And to do that, we must look at harmony created by at least three strings. Song sung by the world. What is going on in the world that needs our attention? And songs sung by the voice of Jesus. What is Jesus encouraging us, inviting us to do, given the circumstances that we are facing? And then there's a song. We sing in our own hearts the song, "What Makes You Glad?" She spoke about a woman, I believe Mary Poole, in Montana, who saw pictures of the Syrian, a Syrian boy, and decided to set up a relocation agency in Montana, where it was not very popular. But that was her song. We each need to find our song by listening carefully, reflectively, by not acting before we listen. And then we need to put all our energy that is possible into that song, whatever it is. And then Donna goes on to say various ways of finding your song. And her sermon, the text, is on our website for you to revisit if you'd like. The other quote I have for you this morning, again, I think it's very apropos, and especially when I read it after hearing Donna's sermon. And it's a quote from Maya Angelou. She says, "We are all at once both a composition and a composer. We have the ability not only to compose the future of our own lives, but to help compose the future of everyone around us and the communities in which we live." So, find your song and sing it. Think of ways to help. And then create your composition that is yours alone. In the name of God, our companion on the journey, and our journey's end. Amen.